collected in every village. I see them gather like the Saxons of old upon the green at evening to sing and dance. I see cities rising near them with schools and churches and concert halls and theaters. I see a day when the farmer will no longer be a drudge and his wife a bond slave, but happy men and women who will go singing to their pleasant tasks upon their fruitful farms. When the boys and girls will not go west nor to the city, when life will be worth living, in that day the moon will be brighter and the stars more glad, and pleasure and poetry and love of life come back to the man who tills the soil. Hamlin Garland dedicated Jason Edwards, written in 1891, to the Farmers' Alliance. It was the Farmers' Alliance that was the core of the great movement of the 1880s and 1890s, later known as the Populist Movement. Between 1860 and 1910, the U.S. Army, wiping out the Indian villages on the Great Plains, paved the way for the railroads to move in and take the best land. Then the farmers came for what was left. From 1860 to 1900, the population of the United States grew from 31 million to 75 million. Now 20 million people lived west of the Mississippi, and the number of farms grew from 2 million to 6 million. With the crowded cities of the East needing food, the internal market for food was more than doubled. 82% of the farm produce was sold inside the United States. Farming became mechanized. Steel plows, mowing machines, reapers, harvesters, improved cotton gins for pulling the fibers away from the seed, and by the turn of the century, giant combines that cut the grain, threshed it, and put it in bags. In 1830, a bushel of wheat had taken 3 hours to produce. By 1900, it took 10 minutes. Specialization developed by region, cotton and tobacco in the South, wheat and corn in the Midwest. Land cost money, and machines cost money, so farmers had to borrow, hoping that the prices of their harvests would stay high, so they could pay the bank for the loan, the railroad for transportation, the grain merchant for handling their grain, the storage elevator for storing it. But they found the prices for their produce going down, and the prices of transportation and loans going up, because the individual farmer could not control the price of his grain, while the monopolist railroad and the monopolist banker could charge what they liked. William Faulkner, in his novel, The Hamlet, described the man on whom Southern farmers depended. He was the largest landholder in one county, and justice of the peace in the next, and election commissioner in both. He was a farmer, a usurer, a veterinarian. He owned most of the good land in the county and held mortgages on most of the rest. He owned the store and the cotton gin and the combined grist mill and blacksmith shop. The farmers who could not pay saw their homes and land taken away. They became tenants. By 1880, 25% of all farms were rented by tenants, and the number kept rising. Many did not even have money to rent and became farm laborers. By 1900, there were 4.5 million farm laborers in the country. It was the fate that awaited every farmer who couldn't pay his debts. Could the squeezed and desperate farmer turn to the government for help? Lawrence Goodwin, in his study of the populist movement, The Democratic Promise, says that after the Civil War, both parties now were controlled by capitalists. They were divided along north-south lines, still hung over with the animosities of the Civil War. This made it very hard to create a party of reform cutting across both parties to unite working people, south and north, to say nothing of black and white, foreign-born and native-born. The government played its part in helping the bankers and hurting the farmers. It kept the amount of money, based on the gold supply, steady while the population rose, so there was less and less money in circulation. The farmer had to pay off his debts in dollars that were harder to get. The bankers, getting the loans back, were getting dollars worth more than when they loaned them out, a kind of interest on top of interest. That is why so much of the talk of farmers' movements in those days had to do with putting more money in circulation, by printing greenbacks, paper money, for which there was no gold in the treasury, or by making silver a basis for issuing money. It was in Texas that the Farmers' Alliance movement began. It was in the South that the crop lien system was the most brutal. By this system, the farmer would get the things he needed from the merchant, the use of the cotton gin at harvest time, whatever supplies were necessary. He didn't have money to pay, so the merchant would get a lien, a mortgage on his crop, on which the farmer might pay 25% interest. Goodwin says, "The crop lien system became for millions of Southerners, white and black, little more than a modified form of slavery. The man with the ledger became to the farmer the furnishing man, to black farmers simply, the man. The farmer would owe more money every year until finally his farm was taken away and he became a tenant." Goodwin gives two personal histories to illustrate this. A white farmer in South Carolina between 1887 and 1895 bought goods and services from the furnishing merchant for $2,681.02, but was able to pay only $687.31, and finally he had to give his land to the merchant. A black farmer named Matt Brown in Black Hawk, Mississippi, between 1884 and 1901, bought his supplies from the Jones store, kept falling further and further behind, and in 1905, the last entry in the merchant's ledger is for a coffin and burial supplies. How many rebellions took place against this system, we don't know. In Delhi, Louisiana, in 1889, a gathering of small farmers rode into town and demolished the stores of merchants to cancel their indebtedness, they said. In the height of the 1877 Depression, a group of white farmers gathered together on a farm in Texas and formed the first Farmers' Alliance. In a few years, it was across the state. By 1882, there were 120 sub-alliances in 12 counties. By 1886, 100,000 farmers had joined in 2,000 sub-alliances. They began to offer alternatives to the old system. Join the alliance and form cooperatives. Buy things together and get lower prices. They began putting their cotton together and selling it cooperatively. They called it bulking. In some states, a grange movement developed. It managed to get laws passed to help farmers. But the Grange, as one of its newspapers put it, is essentially conservative and furnishes a stable, well-organized, rational, and orderly opposition to encroachments upon the liberties of the people, in contrast to the lawless, desperate attempts of communism. It was a time of crisis, and the Grange was doing too little. It lost members while the Farmers' Alliance kept growing. From the beginning, the Farmers' Alliance showed sympathy with the growing labor movement. When Knights of Labor men went on strike against a steamship line in Galveston, Texas, one of the radical leaders of the Texas Alliance, William Lamb, spoke for many, but not all, Alliance members when he said in an open letter to Alliance people, "Knowing that the day is not far distant when the Farmers' Alliance will have to use boycott on manufacturers in order to get goods direct, we think it is a good time to help the Knights of Labor." Goodwin says, "Alliance radicalism, populism, began with this letter." The Texas Alliance president opposed joining the boycott, but a group of Alliance people in Texas passed a resolution. "Whereas we see the unjust encroachments that the capitalists are making upon all the different departments of labor, we extend to the Knights of Labor our hearty sympathy in their manly struggle against monopolistic oppression, and we propose to stand by the Knights." In the summer of 1886, in the town of Cleburne near Dallas, The Alliance gathered and drew up what came to be known as the Cleburne Demands, the first document of the populist movement, asking such legislation as shall secure to our people freedom from the onerous and shameful abuses that the industrial classes are now suffering at the hands of arrogant capitalists and powerful corporations. They called for a national conference of all labor organizations to discuss such measures as may be of interest to the laboring classes, and proposed regulation of railroad rates, heavy taxation of land held only for speculative purposes, and an increase in the money supply. The Alliance kept growing. By early 1887, it had 200,000 members in 3,000 sub-alliances. By 1892, farmer lecturers had gone into 43 states and reached 2 million farm families in what Goodwin calls the most massive organizing drive by any citizen institution of 19th century America. It was a drive based on the idea of cooperation, of farmers creating their own culture, their own political parties, gaining a respect not given them by the nation's powerful industrial and political leaders. Organizers from Texas came to Georgia to form alliances, and in 3 years, Georgia had 100,000 members in 134 of the 137 counties. In Tennessee, there were soon 125,000 members and 3,600 sub-alliances in 92 of the state's 96 counties. The Alliance moved into Mississippi like a cyclone, someone said, and into Louisiana and North Carolina. Then northward into Kansas and the Dakotas, where 35 cooperative warehouses were set up. One of the leading figures in Kansas was Henry Vincent, who started a journal in 1886 called The American Nonconformist and Kansas Industrial Liberator, saying in the first issue, "This journal will aim to publish such matter as will tend to the education of the laboring classes, the farmers, and the producer, and in every struggle it will endeavor to take the side of the oppressed against the oppressor." By 1889, the Kansas Alliance had 50,000 members and was electing local candidates to office. Now there were 400,000 members in the National Farmers Alliance, and the conditions spurring the alliance onward got worse. Corn, which had brought 45 cents a bushel in 1870, brought 10 cents a bushel in 1889. Harvesting wheat required a machine to bind the wheat before it became too dry, and this cost several hundred dollars, which the farmer had to buy on credit, knowing the $200 would be twice as hard to get in a few years. Then he had to pay a bushel of corn in freight costs for every bushel he shipped. He had to pay the high prices demanded by the grain elevators at the terminals. In the South, the situation was worse than anywhere. 90% of the farmers lived on credit. To meet this situation, the Texas Alliance formed a statewide cooperative, a great Texas exchange, which handled the selling of the farmers' cotton in one great transaction. But the exchange itself needed loans to advance credit to its members. The banks refused. A call was issued to farmers to scrape together the needed capital for the exchange to operate. Thousands came on June 9, 1888, to 200 Texas courthouses and made their contributions, pledging $200,000. Ultimately, $80,000 was actually collected. It was not enough. The farmers' poverty prevented them from helping themselves. The banks won, and this persuaded the alliances that monetary reform was crucial. There was one victory along the way. Farmers were being charged too much for jute bags to put cotton in, which were controlled by a trust. The alliance farmers organized a boycott of jute, made their own bags out of cotton, and forced the jute manufacturers to start selling their bags at 5 cents a yard instead of 14 cents. The complexity of populist belief was shown in one of its important leaders in Texas, Charles McCune. He was a radical in economics, antitrust, anti-capitalist, a conservative in politics, against a new party independent of the Democrats, and a racist. McCune came forward with a plan that was to become central to the populist platform, the sub-treasury plan. The government would have its own warehouses where farmers would store produce and get certificates from this sub-treasury. These would be greenbacks, and thus much more currency would be made available, not dependent on gold or silver, but based on the amount of farm produce. There were more alliance experiments. In the Dakotas, a great cooperative insurance plan for farmers insured them against loss of their crops. Where the big insurance companies had asked 50 cents an acre, the cooperative asked 25 cents or less. It issued 30,000 policies covering 2 million acres. McCune's sub-treasury plan depended on the government, and since it would not be taken up by the two major parties, it meant, against McCune's own beliefs, organizing a third party. The alliances went to work. In 1890, 38 alliance people were elected to Congress. In the South, the alliance elected governors in Georgia and Texas. It took over the Democratic Party in Georgia and won 3/4 of the seats in the Georgia legislature, 6 of Georgia's 10 congressmen. This was, however, Goodwin says, an elusive revolution because the party machinery remained in the hands of the old crowd, and the crucial chairmanships of important committees in Congress, in the state legislatures, remained in the hands of the conservatives, and corporate power in the states, in the nation, could use its money to still get what it wanted. The alliances were not getting real power, but they were spreading new ideas and a new spirit. Now, as a political party, they became the People's Party, or Populist Party, and met in convention in 1890 in Topeka, Kansas. The great populist orator from that state, Mary Ellen Lease, told an enthusiastic crowd, "Wall Street owns the country. It is no longer a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, but a government of Wall Street, by Wall Street, and for Wall Street. Our laws are the output of a system which clothes rascals in robes and honesty in rags. The politicians said we suffered from overproduction. Overproduction, when 10,000 little children starve to death every year in the U.S., and over 100,000 shop girls in New York are forced to sell their virtue for bread. There are 30 men in the United States whose aggregate wealth is over $1.5 billion. There are 500,000 looking for work. We want money, land, and transportation. We want the abolition of the national banks, and we want the power to make loans direct from the government. We want the accursed foreclosure system wiped out. We will stand by our homes and stay by our firesides by force if necessary, and we will not pay our debts to the loan shark companies until the government pays its debts to us. The people are at bay. Let the bloodhounds of money who have dogged us thus far beware." At the People's Party National Convention in 1892 in St. Louis, a platform was drawn up. The preamble was written by and read to the assemblage by another of the great orators of the movement, Ignatius Donnelly. "We meet in the midst of a nation brought to the verge of moral, political, and material ruin. Corruption dominates the ballot box, the legislatures, the Congress, and touches even the ermine of the bench. The people are demoralized. The newspapers are subsidized or muzzled, public opinion silenced, business prostrate, our homes covered with mortgages, labor impoverished, and the land concentrating in the hands of capitalists. The urban workmen are denied the right of organization for self-protection. Imported, pauperized labor beats down their wages, a hireling, standing army established to shoot them down. The fruits of the toil of millions are boldly stolen to build up colossal fortunes. From the same prolific womb of governmental injustice, we breed two classes, paupers and millionaires. A People's Party nominating convention in Omaha in July of 1892 nominated James Weaver, an Iowa populist and former general in the Union Army, for president. The populist movement was now tied to the voting system. Their spokesman, Polk, had said they could link their hands and hearts together and march to the ballot box and take possession of the government, restore it to the principles of our fathers, and run it in the interest of the people. Weaver got over 1 million votes, but lost. A new political party had the job of uniting diverse groups, Northern Republicans and Southern Democrats, urban workers and country farmers, black and white. A colored farmers' national alliance grew in the South and had perhaps 1 million members, but it was organized and led by whites. There were also black organizers, but it was not easy for them to persuade black farmers that even if economic reforms were won, blacks would have equal access to them. Blacks had tied themselves to the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln and civil rights laws. The Democrats were the party of slavery and segregation. As Goodwin puts it, in an era of transcendent white prejudice, the curbing of vicious corporate monopoly did not carry for black farmers the ring of salvation it had for white agrarians. There were whites who saw the need for racial unity. One Alabama newspaper wrote, "The white and colored alliance are united in their war against trusts and in the promotion of the doctrine that farmers should establish cooperative stores and manufacturers and publish their own newspapers, conduct their own schools, and have a hand in everything else that concerns them as citizens or affects them personally or collectively." The official newspaper of the Alabama Knights of Labor, the Alabama Sentinel, wrote, "The Bourbon Democracy are trying to down the alliance with the old cry, 'Nigger.' It won't work, though." Some alliance blacks made similar calls for unity. A leader of the Florida Colored Alliance said, "We are aware of the fact that the laboring colored man's interests and the laboring white man's interests are one and the same." When the Texas People's Party was founded in Dallas in the summer of 1891, it was interracial and radical. There was blunt and vigorous debate among whites and blacks. A black delegate active in the Knights of Labor, dissatisfied with vague statements about equality, said, "If we are equal, why does not the sheriff summon Negroes on juries? And why hang up the sign, 'Negro' in passenger cars? I want to tell my people what the People's Party is going to do. I want to tell them if it is going to work a black and white horse in the same field." A white leader responded by urging there be a black delegate from every district in the state. "They are in the ditch just like we are." When someone suggested there be separate white and black populist clubs which could confer together, R. M. Humphrey, the white leader of the Colored Alliance, objected, "This will not do. The colored people are part of the people, and they must be recognized as such." Two blacks were then elected to the state executive committee of the party. Blacks and whites were in different situations. The blacks were mostly field hands, hired laborers. Most white alliance people were farm owners. When the Colored Alliance declared a strike in the cotton fields in 1891 for $1 a day wages for cotton pickers, Leonidas Polk, head of the White Alliance, denounced it as hurting the alliance farmer who would have to pay that wage. In Arkansas, a 30-year-old black cotton picker named Ben Patterson led the strike, traveling from plantation to plantation to get support, his band growing, engaging in gun battles with a white posse. A plantation manager was killed. A cotton gin burned. Patterson and his band were caught, and 15 of them were shot to death. There was some black-white unity at the ballot box in the South, resulting in a few blacks elected in North Carolina local elections. An Alabama white farmer wrote to a newspaper in 1892, "I wish to God that Uncle Sam could put bayonets around the ballot box in the Black Belt on the first Monday in August so that the Negro could get a fair vote." There were black delegates to third-party conventions in Georgia, 2 in 1892, 24 in 1894. The Arkansas People's Party platform spoke for the downtrodden regardless of race. There were moments of racial unity. Lawrence Goodwin found in East Texas an unusual coalition of black and white public officials. It had begun during Reconstruction and continued into the populist period. The state government was in the control of white Democrats, but in Grimes County, blacks won local offices and sent legislators to the state capitol. The district clerk was a black man. There were black deputy sheriffs and a black school principal. A night-riding white man's union used intimidation and murder to split the coalition. But Goodwin points to the long years of interracial cooperation in Grimes County and wonders about missed opportunities. Racism was strong, and the Democratic Party played on this, winning many farmers from the Populist Party. When white tenants, failing in the crop lien system, were evicted from their land and replaced by blacks, race hatred intensified. Southern states were drawing up new constitutions, starting with Mississippi in 1890, to prevent blacks from voting by various devices and to maintain ironclad segregation in every aspect of life. The laws that took the vote away from blacks, poll taxes, literacy tests, property qualifications, also ensured that poor whites would not vote. And the political leaders of the South knew this. At the Constitutional Convention in Alabama, one of the leaders said he wanted to take the vote away from all those who are unfit and unqualified, and if the rule strikes a white man as well as a Negro, let him go. In North Carolina, the Charlotte Observer saw disenfranchisement as the struggle of the white people of North Carolina to rid themselves of the dangers of the rule of Negroes and the lower class of whites. Tom Watson, the populist leader of Georgia, pleaded for racial unity. "You are kept apart that you may be separately fleeced of your earnings. You are made to hate each other because upon that hatred is rested the keystone of the arch of financial despotism which enslaves you both. You are deceived and blinded that you may not see how this race antagonism perpetuates a monetary system which beggars both." According to the black scholar Robert Allen, taking a look at populism, reluctant reformers, Watson wanted black support for a white man's party. No doubt, when Watson found this support embarrassing and no longer useful, he became as eloquent in affirming racism as he had been in opposing it. Still, Watson must have addressed some genuine feelings in poor whites whose class oppression gave them some common interest with blacks. When H.S. Doyle, a young black preacher who supported Watson for Congress, was threatened by a lynch mob, he came to Watson for protection, and 2,000 white farmers helped Doyle escape. It was a time that illustrated the complexities of class and race conflict. 15 blacks were lynched during Watson's election campaign, and in Georgia after 1891, the Alliance-controlled legislature, Allen points out, passed the largest number of anti-black bills ever enacted in a single year in Georgia history. And yet, in 1896, the Georgia state platform of the People's Party denounced lynch law and terrorism and asked the abolition of the convict lease system. C. Van Woodward points to the unique quality of the populist experience in the South. "Never before or since have the two races in the South come so close together as they did during the populist struggles." The populist movement also made a remarkable attempt to create a new and independent culture for the country's farmers. The Alliance Lecture Bureau reached all over the country, It had 35,000 lecturers. The populists poured out books and pamphlets from their printing presses. Woodward says, "One gathers from yellowed pamphlets that the agrarian ideologists undertook to re-educate their countrymen from the ground up. Dismissing history as taught in our schools as practically valueless, they undertook to write it over, formidable columns of it, from the Greek down. With no more compunction, they turned all hands to the revision of economics, political theory, law, and government." The National Economist, a populist magazine, had 100,000 readers. Goodwin counts over 1,000 populist journals in the 1890s. There were newspapers like The Comrade, published in the cotton country of Louisiana, and The Toiler's Friend in rural Georgia. Also, Revolution was published in Georgia. In North Carolina, the populist printing plant was burned. In Alabama, there was The Living Truth. It was broken into in 1892, its type scattered, and the next year the shop was set afire. But the press survived, and the editor never missed an issue. Hundreds of poems and songs came out of the populist movement, like "The Farmer is the Man." The farmer is the man, the farmer is the man. Lives on credit till the fall. With the interest rate so high, it's a wonder he don't die, and the mortgage man's the one that gets it all. The farmer is the man, the farmer is the man. Lives on credit till the fall. And his pants are wearing thin, his condition, it's a sin. He's forgot that he's the man that feeds them all. Books written by populist leaders, such as Henry Damarest Lloyd's Wealth Against Commonwealth and William Harvey Coyne's Financial School, were widely read. An Alabama historian of that time, William Garrett Brown, said about the populist movement that no other political movement, not that of 1776 nor that of 1860 to 61, ever altered Southern life so profoundly. According to Lawrence Goodwin, if the labor movements had been able to do in the cities what the populists did in the rural areas, to create among urban workers a culture of cooperation, self-respect, and economic analysis, there might have been a great movement for change in the United States. There were only fitful, occasional connections between the farmer and labor movements. Neither spoke eloquently enough to the other's needs. And yet there were signs of a common consciousness that might, under different circumstances, lead to a unified, ongoing movement. Norman Pollock says, on the basis of a close study of Midwestern populist newspapers, "Populism regarded itself as a class movement, reasoning that farmers and workers were assuming the same material position in society. An editorial in the Farmers' Alliance spoke of a man working 14 to 16 hours a day. He is brutalized both morally and physically. He has no ideas, only propensities. He has no beliefs, only instincts." Pollock sees that as a homespun version of Marx's idea of workers' alienation from his human self under capitalism, and finds many other parallels between populist and Marxist ideas. Undoubtedly, populists, along with most white Americans, had racism and nativism in their thinking. But part of it was that they simply did not think race as important as the economic system. Thus, the Farmers' Alliance said, "The People's Party has sprung into existence not to make the black man free, but to emancipate all men, to gain for all industrial freedom, without which there can be no political freedom." More important than theoretical connections were the populist expressions of support for workers in actual struggles. The Alliance Independent of Nebraska, during the great strike at the Carnegie Steel Plant, wrote, All who look beneath the surface will see that the bloody battle fought at Homestead was a mere incident in the great conflict between capital and labor. Coxey's March of the Unemployed drew sympathy in the farm areas in Osceola, Nebraska. Perhaps 5,000 people attended a picnic in Coxey's honor. During the Pullman strike, a farmer wrote to the governor of Kansas, "Unquestionably, nearly, if not quite all Alliance people are in fullest sympathy with these striking men." On top of the serious failures to unite blacks and whites, city workers and country farmers, there was the lure of electoral politics, all of that combining to destroy the populist movement. Once allied with the Democratic Party in supporting William Jennings Bryan for president in 1896, populism would drown in a sea of democratic politics. The pressure for electoral victory led populism to make deals with the major parties in city after city. If the Democrats won, it would be absorbed. If the Democrats lost, it would disintegrate. Electoral politics brought into the top leadership the political brokers instead of the agrarian radicals. There were those radical populists who saw this. They said fusion with the Democrats to try to win would lose what they needed, an independent political movement. They said the much-ballyhooed free silver would not change anything fundamental in the capitalist system. One Texas radical said silver coinage would leave undisturbed all the conditions which give rise to the undue concentration of wealth. Henry Damarest Lloyd noted that the Bryan nomination was subsidized in part by Marcus Daly of Anaconda Copper and William Randolph Hearst of the silver interests in the West. He saw through the rhetoric of Bryan that stirred the crowd of 20,000 at the Democratic Convention. "We have petitioned, and our petitions have been scorned. We have entreated, and our entreaties have been disregarded. We have begged, and they have mocked when our calamity came. We beg no longer. We entreat no more. We petition no more. We defy them." Lloyd wrote bitterly, "The poor people are throwing up their hats in the air for those who promise to lead them out of the wilderness by way of the currency route. The people are to be kept wandering 40 years in the currency labyrinth, as they have for the last 40 years been led up and down the tariff bill." In the election of 1896, with the populist movement enticed into the Democratic Party, Bryan, the Democratic candidate, was defeated by William McKinley, for whom the corporations and the press mobilized in the first massive use of money in an election campaign. Even the hint of populism in the Democratic Party, it seemed, could not be tolerated, and the big guns of the establishment pulled out all their ammunition to make sure. It was a time, as election times have often been in the United States, to consolidate the system after years of protest and rebellion. The black was being kept under control in the South. The Indian was being driven off the Western Plains for good. On a cold winter day in 1890, U.S. Army soldiers attacked Indians camped at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, and killed 300 men, women, and children. It was the climax to 400 years of violence that began with Columbus, establishing that this continent belonged to white men, but only to certain white men, because it was clear by 1896 that the state stood ready to crush labor strikes by law if possible, by force if necessary. And where a threatening mass movement developed, the two-party system stood ready to send one of its columns to surround that movement and drain it of vitality. And always, as a way of drowning class resentment in a flood of slogans for national unity, there was patriotism. McKinley had said in a rare rhetorical connection between money and flag, "This year is going to be a year of patriotism and devotion to country. I am glad to know that the people in every part of the country mean to be devoted to one flag, the glorious stars and stripes. that the people of this country mean to maintain the financial honor of the country as sacredly as they maintain the honor of the flag. The supreme act of patriotism was war. 2 years after McKinley became president, the United States declared war on Spain.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Chapter 12, The Empire and the People. Theodore Roosevelt wrote to a friend in the year 1897, "In strict confidence, I should welcome almost any war, for I think this country needs one." The year of the massacre at Wounded Knee, 1890, it was officially declared by the Bureau of the Census that the internal frontier was closed. The profit system, with its natural tendency for expansion, had already begun to look overseas. The severe depression that began in 1893 strengthened an idea developing within the political and financial elite of the country that overseas markets for American goods might relieve the problem of underconsumption at home and prevent the economic crises that in 1890s brought class war. And would not a foreign adventure deflect some of the rebellious energy that went into strikes and protest movements toward an external enemy? Would it not unite people with government, with the armed forces, instead of against them? This was probably not a conscious plan among most of the elite, but a natural development from the twin drives of capitalism and nationalism. Expansion overseas was not a new idea. Even before the war against Mexico carried the United States to the Pacific, the Monroe Doctrine looked southward into and beyond the Caribbean. Issued in 1823, when the countries of Latin America were winning independence from Spanish control, it made plain to European nations that the United States considered Latin America its sphere of influence. Not long after, some Americans began thinking into the Pacific, of Hawaii, Japan, and the great markets of China. There was more than thinking. The American armed forces had made forays overseas. A State Department list, Instances of the Use of United States Armed Forces Abroad, 1798 to 1945, presented by Secretary of State Dean Rusk to a Senate committee in 1962 to cite precedents for the use of armed force against Cuba, shows 103 interventions in the affairs of other countries between 1798 and 1895. A sampling from the list, with the exact description given by the State Department. 1852 to 53, Argentina. Marines were landed and maintained in Buenos Aires to protect American interests during a revolution. 1853, Nicaragua. To protect American lives and interests during political disturbances. 1853 to 54, Japan. The opening of Japan and the Perry Expedition. The State Department does not give more details, but this involved the use of warships to force Japan to open its ports to the United States. 1853 to 54, Ryukyu and Bonin Islands. Commodore Perry, on three visits before going to Japan and while waiting for a reply from Japan, made a naval demonstration, landing Marines twice, and secured a coaling concession from the ruler of Naha and Okinawa. He also demonstrated in the Bonin Islands, all to secure facilities for commerce. 1854, Nicaragua. San Juan del Norte. Greytown was destroyed to avenge an insult to the American minister to Nicaragua. 1855, Uruguay. U.S. and European naval forces landed to protect American interests during an attempted revolution in Montevideo. 1859, China. For the protection of American interests in Shanghai. 1860, Angola, Portuguese West Africa. To protect American lives and property at Kisembo when the natives became troublesome. 1893, Hawaii. Ostensibly to protect American lives and property, actually to promote a provisional government under Sanford B. Dole. This action was disavowed by the United States. 1894, Nicaragua. To protect American interests at Bluefields following a revolution. Thus, by the 1890s, there had been much experience in overseas probes and interventions. The ideology of expansion was widespread in the upper circles of military men, politicians, businessmen, and even among some of the leaders of farmers' movements who thought foreign markets would help them. Captain A.T. Mahan of the U.S. Navy, a popular propagandist for expansion, greatly influenced Theodore Roosevelt and other American leaders. The countries with the biggest navies would inherit the earth, he said. Americans must now begin to look outward. Senator Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts wrote in a magazine article, "In the interests of our commerce, we should build the Nicaragua Canal, and for the protection of that canal, and for the sake of our commercial supremacy in the Pacific, we should control the Hawaiian Islands and maintain our influence in Samoa. And when the Nicaraguan Canal is built, the island of Cuba will become a necessity. The great nations are rapidly absorbing for their future expansion and their present defense all the waste places of the earth. It is a movement which makes for civilization and the advancement of the race. As one of the great nations of the world, the United States must not fall out of the line of that march." A Washington Post editorial on the eve of the Spanish-American War. "A new consciousness seems to have come upon us, the consciousness of strength, and with it a new appetite, the yearning to show our strength. Ambition, interest, land hunger, pride, the mere joy of fighting, whatever it may be, we are animated by a new sensation. We are face to face with a strange destiny. The taste of empire is in the mouth of the people, even as the taste of blood in the jungle." Was that taste in the mouth of the people through some instinctive lust for aggression or some urgent self-interest? Or was it a taste, if indeed it existed, created, encouraged, advertised, and exaggerated by the millionaire press, the military, the government, the eager-to-please scholars of the time? Political scientist John Burgess of Columbia University said the Teutonic and Anglo-Saxon races were particularly endowed with the capacity for establishing national states. They are entrusted with the mission of conducting the political civilization of the modern world. Several years before his election to the presidency, William McKinley said, "We want a foreign market for our surplus products." Senator Albert Beveridge of Indiana in early 1897 declared, "American factories are making more than the American people can use. American soil is producing more than they can consume. Fate has written our policy for us. The trade of the world must and shall be ours." The Department of State explained in 1898, "It seems to be conceded that every year we shall be confronted with an increasing surplus of manufactured goods for sale in foreign markets, if American operatives and artisans are to be kept employed the year around. The enlargement of foreign consumption of the products of our mills and workshops has therefore become a serious problem of statesmanship as well as of commerce." These expansionist military men and politicians were in touch with one another. One of Theodore Roosevelt's biographers tells us, "By 1890, Lodge, Roosevelt, and Mahan had begun exchanging views, and that they tried to get Mahan off sea duty so that he could continue full-time his propaganda for expansion." Roosevelt once sent Henry Cabot Lodge a copy of a poem by Rudyard Kipling, saying, "It was poor poetry, but good sense from the expansionist standpoint." When the United States did not annex Hawaii in 1893, after some Americans, the combined missionary and pineapple interests of the Dole family, set up their own government, Roosevelt called this hesitancy a crime against white civilization, and he told the Naval War College, "All the great masterful races have been fighting races. No triumph of peace is quite so great as the supreme triumph of war." Roosevelt was contemptuous of races and nations he considered inferior. When a mob in New Orleans lynched a number of Italian immigrants, Roosevelt thought the United States should offer the Italian government some remuneration, but privately he wrote his sister that he thought the lynching was rather a good thing, and told her he had said as much at a dinner with various Dago diplomats all wrought up by the lynching. William James, the philosopher who became one of the leading anti-imperialists of his time, wrote about Roosevelt that he gushes over war as the ideal condition of human society for the manly strenuousness which it involves, and treats peace as a condition of blubber-like and swollen ignobility, fit only for huckstering weaklings dwelling in gray twilight and heedless of the higher life. Roosevelt's talk of expansionism was not just a matter of manliness and heroism. He was conscious of our trade relations with China. Lodge was aware of the textile interests in Massachusetts that looked to Asian markets. Historian Marilyn Young has written of the work of the American China Development Company to expand American influence in China for commercial reasons, and of State Department instructions to the American emissary in China to employ all proper methods for the extension of American interests in China. She says, the rhetoric of empire, that the talk about markets in China was far greater than the actual amount of dollars involved at the time. But this talk was important in shaping American policy toward Hawaii, the Philippines, and all of Asia. While it was true that in 1898, 90% of American products were sold at home, the 10% sold abroad amounted to $1 billion. Walter Lefebvre writes in The New Empire, "By 1893, American trade exceeded that of every country in the world except England. Farm products, of course, especially in the key tobacco, cotton, and wheat areas, had long depended heavily on international markets for their prosperity. And in the 20 years up to 1895, new investments by American capitalists overseas reached $1 billion. In 1885, the steel industry's publication, Age of Steel, wrote that the internal markets were insufficient and the overproduction of industrial products should be relieved and prevented in the future by increased foreign trade. Oil became a big export in the 1880s and 1890s. By 1891, the Rockefeller family's Standard Oil Company accounted for 90% of American exports of kerosene and controlled 70% of the world market. Oil was now second to cotton as the leading product sent overseas. There were demands for expansion by large commercial farmers, including some of the populist leaders, as William Appleman Williams has shown in The Roots of the Modern American Empire. Populist Congressman Jerry Simpson of Kansas told Congress in 1892 that with a huge agricultural surplus, farmers must of necessity seek a foreign market. True, he was not calling for aggression or conquest, but once foreign markets were seen as important to prosperity, expansionist policies, even war, might have wide appeal. Such an appeal would be especially strong if the expansion looked like an act of generosity, helping a rebellious group overthrow foreign rule, as in Cuba. By 1898, Cuban rebels had been fighting their Spanish conquerors for 3 years in an attempt to win independence. By that time, it was possible to create a national mood for intervention. It seems that the business interests of the nation did not at first want military intervention in Cuba. American merchants did not need colonies or wars of conquest if they could just have free access to markets. This idea of an open door became the dominant theme of the American foreign policy in the 20th century. It was a more sophisticated approach to imperialism than the traditional empire building of Europe. William Appleman Williams in The Tragedy of American Diplomacy says, "This national argument is usually interpreted as a battle between imperialists, led by Roosevelt and Lodge, and anti-imperialists, led by William Jennings Bryan and Carl Schurz. It is far more accurate and illuminating, however, to view it as a three-cornered fight. The third group was a coalition of businessmen, intellectuals, and politicians who opposed traditional colonialism and advocated instead a policy of an open door through which America's preponderant economic strength would enter and dominate all underdeveloped areas of the world. However, this preference on the part of some business groups and politicians for what Williams calls the idea of informal empire without war was always subject to change. If peaceful imperialism turned out to be impossible, military action might be needed. For instance, in late 1897 and early 1898, with China weakened by a recent war with Japan, German military forces occupied the Chinese port of Qingdao at the mouth of Kiaochow Bay and demanded a naval station there with rights to railways and coal mines on the nearby peninsula of Shantung. Within the next few months, other European powers moved in on China, and the partition of China by the major imperialist powers was underway, with the United States left behind. At this point, the New York Journal of Commerce, which had advocated peaceful development of free trade, now urged old-fashioned military colonialism. Julius Pratt, a historian of U.S. expansionism, describes the turnabout. "The paper, which has been heretofore characterized as pacifist, anti-imperialist, and devoted to the development of commerce in a free trade world, saw the foundation of its faith crumbling as a result of the threatened partition of China. Declaring that free access to the markets of China, with its 400 million people, would largely solve the problem of the disposal of our surplus manufacturers, the journal came out not only for a stern insistence upon complete equality of rights in China, but unreservedly also for an Isthmian canal, the acquisition of Hawaii, and a material increase in the Navy, three measures which it had hitherto strenuously opposed. Nothing could be more significant than the manner in which this paper was converted in a few weeks." There was a similar turnabout in U.S. business attitudes on Cuba in 1898. Businessmen had been interested, from the start of the Cuban revolt against Spain, in the effect on commercial possibilities there. There already was a substantial economic interest in the island, which President Grover Cleveland summarized in 1896. It is reasonably estimated that at least from $30 million to $50 million of American capital are invested in the plantations and in railroad, mining, and other business enterprises on the island. The volume of trade between the United States and Cuba, which in 1889 amounted to about $64 million, rose in 1893 to about $103 million. Popular support of the Cuban Revolution was based on the thought that they, like the Americans of 1776, were fighting a war for their own liberation. The United States government, however, the conservative product of another revolutionary war, had power and profit in mind as it observed the events in Cuba. Neither Cleveland, president during the first years of the Cuban revolt, nor McKinley, who followed, recognized the insurgents officially as belligerents. Such legal recognition would have enabled the United States to give aid to the rebels without sending an army. But there may have been fear that the rebels would win on their own and keep the United States out. There seems also to have been another kind of fear. The Cleveland administration said a Cuban victory might lead to the establishment of a white and a black republic, since Cuba had a mixture of the two races, and the black republic might be dominant. This idea was expressed in 1896 in an article in the Saturday Review by a young and eloquent imperialist whose mind